This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The New York Times and Wall Street Journal will be just fine in today's changing media landscape, but no one is talking about the small towns.
Where their paper folds because there's just no financial support for it. That is truly a tragedy. No one's watching school boards. No one's watching elected officials.
Emmy-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien talks with Eric Stock. Plus, normal town council member Karen Smith takes exception to the conventional wisdom on calculating public benefit and outside investment in Uptown Normal. And WGLT correspondent Brianna Groh tackles artificial intelligence and its potential to transform the future.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. If the past is prologue, there is a disagreement on what the past means for Uptown Normal. A recent report on the tax increment financing district in Normal drew praise from some council members who've seen the area go from dumpy and run down to a vibrant district. The report went to the council without a chance for members to read it beforehand because the TIF administrator was still finishing it up. Now, Normal council member Karen Smith has had a chance to digest the results. In this talk, Smith questions some of the conclusions of the report, but says it has enhanced her understanding of TIF and of the way Uptown used to look.
My understanding is that the TIF program is intended to provide governments with a way to attract private investment to an area that is defined as blighted. That Normal did pursue that. And seeing some of the pictures he displayed of the previous uptown, downtown Normal area were images I had not seen since, again, we did not arrive on the scene till 2008. One statement he made during his presentation was parking statement spaces and requirements for elevators kill deals. So my sense from that was that when private developers are asked to upgrade spaces and modernize them, possibly for current use, they no longer grandfathered in. And so there are requirements to make those buildings satisfy current codes.
Are pretty steep often.
And it comes with a price tag. And so in a sense, some of this program looks like we're funding what we may be creating as unfunded mandates.
Unpack that one for me. I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Well, the American Disability Act was passed in the 1990s, and thankfully it recognized the desire to make disabled citizens full members of our community and to make those individuals have access to everything. We now require that any time older spaces are converted to new use, that they must, in fact, provide accessibility. And if it's a second story, that means an elevator.
But his contention is that it's not usually, or it's often more difficult to make a renovation and retrofit economically viable from the revenue generated by the renovation than it is to build new. That's how I took his comment at the meeting. How did you take it?
I took his comment at the meeting as in order to modernize that this was a cost of the development and that many private investors might not be willing to bear that. But if they could have a government partner, they would be more willing to invest their dollars.
I thought he was talking only about the difference between new and renovated spaces.
We didn't get into that. We didn't get into that distinction in my discussion with him because what I was focusing on more in my follow-up with him was the semantics of how he was measuring investment. And this is where I think there comes the disagreement, because he did acknowledge that a successful TIF is one that attracts private investment. And ultimately, the objective is for government to step back and a revitalized area to be so attractive that private investors are clamoring to get into those spaces.
The report suggests that the TIF is a functioning TIF in that it has produced a large amount of private investment from a smaller amount of public investment. Do you buy that?
This is where I was pushing him in our phone conversation, because as I was taking the notes, and it's not exactly clear from the copies of the slides, because it's a little hard to read with two slides to a page, he took as the private investment dollar amount $167 million. The local dollar amount was $90 million, and state and federal grants totaling $37 million, for a total of nearly $300 million.
Total.
He isolated and equated Normal's investment in the TIF as only the $90 million, so that by his calculation, we are putting in 30% and getting a 70% offset for those government dollars.
You don't agree with that?
I do not agree with that, because those state and federal grants are still coming from taxpayer-funded programs.
But they would not come to Bloomington Normal but for the local contribution.
And he did make that point. I'm not against accepting the money, but what I'm saying is it's disingenuous to not include that as what we are using to support this project. That our tax dollars are, in essence, a part of those state and local grants and should be included, which would bring it to a ratio of 127 over the 294, or 43%. And also,
the standard argument, though, for counting it the other way is that money, that state and federal money, would be going somewhere, if not here. And so it's only fair to count it as money attracted to the community from local action, because it was going to be spent anyway. So it's not like it would not have been spent.
I disagree with that perspective, because I think until we as a community, as a state, and as a nation begin to realize that programs that are for the public good are paid for the public, whether it's out of a pocket that we call local taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, or income taxes, we have to recognize it does represent a burden to taxpayers. And we should evaluate programs on the basis of are the
total burden to taxpayers.
Total burden to taxpayers. Okay. And also, when I alerted him to the rents that are paid for the Uptown One space, he acknowledged that those are above market rents. And rightfully, the marginal amount that is above the market rate should also be factored in to support and investment in this TIF project.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Karen Smith, a Normal Town Council member. The town of Normal has historically resisted characterizing them as above market. They've said they're at market for that class of office space. Do you buy that?
I do not.
Why not?
If you look at the square footage and the type of space, and you look at comparables, that we're not providing the similar amenities for any other government offices in this community. And I believe that it is dollars that could be better spent elsewhere. In looking at the TIF program, one of the things that concerns me is that the original plan was developed in the 1990s. We're 20 years from that. There is a push now to complete Trail East, and the mayor has been in your offices to discuss the ideas.
Trail West.
Trail West, Trail South, and did make some mention of the library. There's been publication of the soccer complex. I contend. Let's
treat the soccer complex as something else. But all of the other things you mentioned, south of the train tracks and Trail West, are all in the master plan for Uptown. So those things have been vetted and contributed to over decades by a wide variety of focus groups, community stakeholders, and public officials, and various city town councils.
And it's more than 20 years since that vetting occurred. And what we're looking at now is, from an economic standpoint, that we are in the 11th year of the longest expansion in history. Your own radio station has reported that McLean County represents the largest recipient of farm subsidy funding. Looking in the audit report, the population here in Normal is holding steady at around 54,500 from 2015 to 2019. The principal employers in the community are at 26,975 in 2019, when they were up 29,673 in 2010.
So you're arguing what? That this we should call a halt to all of this?
I'm not arguing for a halt, but I'm arguing for at least the ability to pause and look more closely at focusing on Trail East, if that is what is already on the books. The agreements have been signed. I have been pushing for a discussion of at least allowing a discussion of the possibility of modifying the design to allow saving the facades. What would be wrong with having that discussion? Because we're already committed to a cost in the neighborhood of $100,000 simply to move the mural wall. But you find citizens that are anxious about the fact that they're losing a finite amount of historical spaces, and it may not satisfy the historical preservation definition, but it does represent history to our long-term residents. And we haven't provided any opportunity for those individuals to weigh in and at least hear their concerns.
Well, let's back up. And the historical content argument is separate from the Trail East cost itself. Are you arguing that the town should go back on an already decided development agreement to try to redo what has been decided and redo something that the developers have begun to move on as part of that contract?
I am arguing that there should be a discussion of, is the town as a whole still in support of a design that is modeled after plans that were developed 20 years ago by firms out of the Chicago area that provided a specific look to Normal that does not necessarily sync with the image that long-term residents have of their community.
You've mentioned Chicago area a couple of times. Is that significant? Why is that significant, whether they're from Chicago or not?
It's significant in the sense that that is a large urban area, and we are a small area with 150,000. The community has a different feel than an urban area.
But elected officials and stakeholders who decided that plan also accepted that plan once the designs came in. It was not as if it happened in a vacuum.
Prior to Mr. Nord's and my tenure on the Normal Council, I know from my attending those meetings, there was not much discussion that took place in front of the public. I was frustrated from going to meetings when I would see on the agenda items that indicated they were being addressed, but the vast majority of those were incorporated into an omnibus agenda, and there was minimal, if any, discussion.
But when those master plans were formed, when the design for Uptown was contemplated, when these things that have now become Uptown were in development, there were large numbers of charrettes community focus groups, stakeholder meetings, and then it all funneled into the report, which went to the town council, which approved it, and then the town council has approved each subsequent piece of implementation. That is seeming to be the way government should work, right?
The actions you are mentioning are 20 years old, possibly 15 for some of the actions when some of the proposals were implemented and put into place.
And new proposals all come through the council as well. Trail East came through the council before you were on the council. Trail West, if there ever is one, will come to the council. Is this not the way things should work?
Trail East, in my mind, was pushed through the council. It's a part of my complaint with the Attorney General that I was not permitted to make a comment about putting on the discussion an effort to have any input about saving the facades. I actually spoke to Mayor Coos in advance of the meeting and asked him if he believed so strongly in it, then defend it. Have it on the meeting, but that did not happen. And so what I'm stating is I am not seeking to uproot government and void government structure. What I am saying, nothing is harmed by having conversations. And what frustrates myself as a member on the council is that there seemed to be a real pushback against simply allowing the opportunity to air this as something that people want to express their opinion.
They have the opportunity for public comment. They have the opportunity to weigh in, don't they?
The opportunity for public comment has been restricted to anything that's on the agenda. Up until recently, they had to formulate their desire and submit that by 5 p.m. the night of the council meeting. That was expanded to 15 minutes prior to the meeting.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Karen Smith, a Normal Town Council member. Returning to the TIF report, your contention that the state and federal grants should be counted as public investment rather than on the side of the ledger that is money stimulated for investment by the local investment. What do you believe that says about the worthiness of the TIF?
As I see what has been done so far, I am impressed. I'm not passing judgment by what has been completed. What I am calling into question is a blind allegiance to continuing on the path as originally set out 20 years ago. As I mentioned earlier, there are a number of economic indicators which call into question whether or not there should be a continued push to proceed with any future development until we are certain that the economy can support it. That in looking at the revenue streams, the town of Normal has in fact nearly doubled the receipts from sales tax. But that's not because we have had higher sales. It's because in large part the sales tax rate went from 1.25% in 2010 to 2.5% in 2015, 2016. And so if you divide that by two, what you see is a fairly stagnant level of sales tax receipt. And that higher sales tax receipt is supporting higher costs, but for the most part, those higher costs are driven by the increased expense of the debt service on these bonds. And that is where the semantics gets into what counts as an investment versus, no, we don't want to count the interest. It's all a matter of what are you putting on the balance sheet and what are you putting on the income statement. On the balance sheet, the argument is it's the $90 million investment of the bonds that were used to fund this TIF. But on the income statement, you can't get away from the fact that these bonds have an interest expense associated with them that has to be paid every year until they're retired.
And the town has done so and has identified income to devote to that.
Yes, it has, but it has come at a price. It has come at the expense of increasing the sales tax rate from 1.25 to 2.5.
The increase in the sales tax rate was not really to do that. It was to pay for other things.
You can't really isolate and dedicate funds and say, I'm only going to use it for these purposes. You must look at the expenses as a whole, that as a community, we have a commitment to what we pay and what we support and how we slice and dice the dollars that are allocated to make that happen. You can make a commitment that we are going to raise taxes through this method to fund this particular program. But at the end of the day, you are still asking your citizens to support these ventures, and it's coming out of their pockets.
So what do you think should be done with this TIF report?
Well, the TIF report, as it stands, I don't have a problem with it. I think it should be revised to incorporate the marginal rents from the Uptown One space to factor that in to the $90 million that is the town support. I would argue that there should be a recognition that the taxpayers are, in fact, funding a larger percentage of this. And as Mr. Weber indicated in his report, the success is measured by the amount of private investment. That's where I think it's time for another discussion. When can the town of Normal back away? Because now private investors on their own see this as a community that is attractive to them, that they want to be a part of.
Well, that's a question for the council, whether they want Trail West, whether they believe that the Uptown Master Plan should be finished, whether they believe Uptown 2.0 should proceed in any fashion whatsoever. And you're going to have a voice in that.
It's not simply up to the council. We are elected to represent the citizens of this community. And I would not sleep well at night if I were making this decision without the feedback of the larger community.
Karen Smith is a member of the Normal Town Council. Town of Normal officials say Smith's assertions regarding sales tax revenue growth attributed to higher rates instead of economic growth are not accurate. And the TIF reports indicate the TIF report indicates significant sales tax growth within the TIF separate from the increase in the sales tax rate. The council meets tonight. On the agenda is a draft tax levy.
Support for WGLT comes from the Organizational Leadership Institute at Illinois State's College of Business, where professionals can participate in personal leadership development with programs like Caterpillar Leadership Fellows and the Leadership Case Competition. Details at business.illinoisstate.edu. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a conversation with Emmy Award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien. Are we humans prepared for all the ways artificial intelligence will change the way we travel, work, and communicate with others? Not yet, but we can be, says AI expert Dr. Raj Ramesh. GLT correspondent Brianna Groh speaks with Ramesh about his upcoming TEDx Normal Talk called How to Think, Transform, and Thrive in the Future.
Computers have been around for a long time, but they're basically good at digital processing and information processing. They can consume a lot of information and spit out a summary or process them effectively. But there's this other aspect of cognitive abilities of the human mind that have not been replicated on computers or AI systems. So on one hand, computers are good at handling digital information, but we humans are good at handling conceptual information. And so if we can bring the two together, that'll be the best of both worlds. I don't think we'll get to incorporating the full range of cognitive abilities that the humans have into computers anytime soon.
Do you think that would, in theory, be possible to have machines get to a place where they can recreate that sort of creative, conceptual thinking of humans?
It is always possible, and it is always difficult to predict the future. And there is no theoretical limit on why that is not possible. But we have to have a couple, more than a couple of breakthroughs to get to the point where we truly can make computers better, in some sense, cognitively, than humans. And people have been talking about this point of singularity, where the human intelligence will be surpassed by computing intelligence. But the singularity is probably not going to be a single point, because there are different aspects of human intelligence that can be surpassed, but not all. And so that's an open question still in the community, and we haven't really pinned down what the singularity is.
Yeah, so that might be far off in the future, if ever. In the meantime, you are focusing on how humans have this sort of creative intelligence and ability. But you also argue that our society isn't doing a great job of teaching people how to harness that, right? So tell me about that.
When kids go to school from kindergarten, we have a natural ability to draw. And that's how we express our thoughts. But school has educated us out of that and have taught us how to read and write and speak, but haven't focused too much on the art of drawing and doodling and these kinds of expressive art. As we learn to read and write or speak, these are linear things, which means that if I read a sentence, I have to have understood the sentence prior to that to be able to understand this sentence, and so on. So it's linear. Likewise is speaking. I have to say one sentence, and then you listen to this next sentence, and so on. But if you take a picture, it's two-dimensional. I can jump from one point to the other without having to go through a linear fashion. And it's a great form to express our mental models so that communication becomes more effective. And this is something computers can't do.
Is this why we see that technology with self-driving vehicles is having difficulty advancing, is that they can't make decisions with visual feedback very well?
It is a complicated problem indeed, because what humans do is humans have this natural ability to look at an object and recognize the object for what it is. When I look at a chair, I see a chair. I don't see the different pixels that make up the chair. A computer, on the other hand, can only see the different pixels and tries to put that information together. And that's why it has problems, because it can be trained to recognize a chair, but it is much more difficult for us to train it to recognize that the chair is meant for sitting, and therefore I can take any surface and use it as a sitting surface. These are human capabilities, but computers can't be, do not understand how to recognize that. So they just put together to try to create these concepts, but don't understand the basics behind the concepts or the functionality behind the concepts, which is a major problem. And that's why maybe self-driving cars have a lot of processing to do, because they have to recognize the scene, put together that scene, create a model of that scene inside, and figure out what to do with that scene at every second, or less, or at every microsecond, possibly.
Yeah, but this is a skill that we as humans already can do naturally. Why is building this skill important for the future?
We have this, obviously, this natural ability, and we've not exploited it much. And most of us are concerned in some way or the other, either for ourselves or for our kids or for the next generation, that computers might take over our jobs. So this is a really scary thing. So if you want to position yourself at complementary to what computers can do, then I think this is a skill that will not be learned by computers anytime soon, or artificial intelligence by anytime soon. So it is up to us to figure out how to leverage this skill better so we can put ourselves in a better position. I think we should focus on that aspect and leave the drudgery work to computers and artificial intelligence, at least for the near future.
I'm talking with Dr. Raj Ramesh. He's an international speaker and consultant, as well as the chief AI officer at Data Foundry. You were just talking about how there are certain tasks that increasingly are and have been automated by artificial intelligence machines. Can you give me a summary of how that's happened in the past and your predictions about what jobs might be automated in the future?
Sure. In the past, we have used computers to deal with digital information to essentially follow instructions that programmers had given them. So when I, as a programmer, write some code, I'm instructing the computer to do certain things. But now we are moving into a realm where we ourselves do not know how the human brain works. For example, if I recognize your face in a crowd, I can instantaneously recognize that without essentially going through a sequence of steps in my own mind. So therefore, there is this set of problems that we don't know how to quantify, but it so happens that we have figured out a way to train a computer based on lots of data. So if I can give a lot of faces to the computer, it can build a model so that it can recognize those faces. It basically does pattern recognition. This means that whenever there is a pattern to be recognized, that particular task or job can be taken over by machines in the future. But there are many parts of work that do not require pattern recognition or call for something other than pattern recognition. So in the future, if we can learn how to better adapt, then we can be at a better position to complement the strengths of what computers can do. So there are pieces of the job that will not be taken over by computers, or there'll be new jobs that'll be created which require for a higher level of thinking and skills that we should seek.
This is like what we've seen in the medical field, where machines can use pattern detecting to potentially provide diagnostic results from testing or scanning. But you still need a doctor to interpret those results.
That's right. That's right. Because true that machines can look at one X-ray and figure out what the problem is, but it can't look at the human or the patient holistically and understand how something else may be connected with this, may be connected with something else. So it is poorer. Machines are generally poorer at connecting different domains. They can work very well, especially in pattern recognition, in a very narrow space. But it's very difficult for them to connect across, which humans, on the other hand, are very good at. They can take disparate things and connect them together and figure out what's going on at a higher level of cognitive ability.
So that skill that you just described of connecting different realms when we're talking about problem solving, that's what you're thinking humans will need, especially to solve some of our bigger problems that we're facing in the future, right? What problems are we going to need that skill to be able to solve?
You could take an example of food distribution in the world and solving world hunger. We don't have a problem as far as food production goes. There is enough food to feed everybody in the world, but it's a distribution problem. We don't know how to get food to the right people at the right time. So that's a huge problem that can be solved by creative thinking and problem-solving approaches. And if we can use some of the computing machinery to help, that would be great, but computers by themselves will not be able to help solve that problem. We as humans have to take the initiative to figure out where human ingenuity will play a role and where computers can play a role.
I was having a look around your YouTube channel, and they all include these doodles that you do. Why is drawing an important part of learning to think creatively?
I think if you look at humans, we're, as I said earlier, we're visual learners. So what happens is that by virtue of drawing something on paper, I'm taking what's my mental model and translating it on paper. And amazingly, this same mental model seems to be going into the minds of the listener and the observer, and they seem to be building the same or similar mental model in their own space. What happens in this process is if it's interactive, there's an exchange of ideas, and we internally adjust each of our mental models and come to some common agreement or pretty close mental models. And that's how learning takes place. And I think that drawing is one of the most effective ways to do that.
You were talking about how other forms of communication are linear, so there's kind of at any point in time a chance for something to be lost in translation or the understanding to not be mutual. But drawing is almost like kind of a telepathy where you see it and my message is communicated to your brain.
That's right, that's right. Because when you write something, when I write a sentence, I do not know how it could be interpreted by you. And there are many ways, the range of interpretations is higher. And if I write a paragraph, that's even higher. If I write a whole page, that's even higher. And essentially, when I write something, it could be interpreted completely different by you. But with drawing, on the other hand, then the boundaries are a little bit narrower, and I know exactly that you will probably stay within those boundaries and understand the concepts that I'm trying to communicate. And that's why I use drawing as a tool in my YouTube videos, and it seems to be very effective.
For people who want to harness this creative power of drawing and more effective communication, how do you get started, and do you have to be an artist?
I don't think you need to be an artist. You can, as I said earlier, we all have natural drawing skills. And these drawings initially can be personal to you. If you draw a box, it's a box. And if you interpret that box as a chair, it's a chair. If you interpret that box as a picture, it is a picture. Whatever it is that you want it to represent, it is yours to claim. So there is no right or wrong with drawing. To get started, I would say you can start out with very simple basic shapes like rectangles and triangles and circles and maybe lines to represent different things. So any object, if you want to draw, for example, a complicated object like a school, then if you can't draw a school, all you need to draw is you need to draw a box and just write school on it, and that becomes a school. You don't have to represent it, replicate it exactly like a school. So it is up to you, and it's very easy to draw things, and you can get comfortable in your own environment where nobody is judging you, because all you are seeking to do is to understand the world around you just by yourself. You don't really care who's going to look at the drawings.
Okay. Anything else you want to share with me about your upcoming talk?
This is the concept that I have been working on for more than 10 years. I just want to spread the word that this is good to know, and you should try it yourself as well, no matter what your area of expertise is. Mine happens to be AI, but it could be in medicine, it could be in plumbing, it could be in any wide variety of topics. So I just believe that drawings totally help us understand the world around us and adapt to it.
That's Dr. Raj Ramesh, a TEDx Normal speaker, speaking with WGLT correspondent Brianna Groh. This year's TEDx Normal event runs from 9 a.m. to noon, November 16th at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State is consistently ranked among the top universities nationwide by U.S. News & World Report, which cites Illinois State's academic quality and excellence. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Emmy Award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien calls herself a champion of diversity who gives voice to the underserved and disenfranchised. She's likely best known for work on CNN, where she spent months covering the devastation left by Hurricane Katrina. O'Brien is the keynote speaker at Illinois State University's Latino Cultural Dinner at the Bone Student Center tonight. O'Brien tells WGLT's Eric Stock, covering the Katrina catastrophe and its aftermath became a touchstone moment that shaped her career as a documentary producer and host.
I don't think I really thought about how journalism could help move the needle on stories until I started covering Hurricane Katrina. you know, I thought of myself as a reporter. I go out and I tell stories. But in terms of journalism being leveraged to bring attention of the world to a breaking news story, I think I really began to understand the actual potential power of that during Hurricane Katrina. That, you know, everybody's watching and they weren't there. And you had to be able to tell stories of people who really had no voice. I mean, literally had no voice at all. And then I think that's when I figured out that there was just a lot of power in that.
Where do you feel the media goes wrong when reporting on issues of diversity?
Oh, my God. How much time do we have in this? because, I, you know, I'm sort of kind of being joking-ish. I think the media goes wrong in reporting on diversity in many ways. But probably the biggest way is the point of view is from a white perspective, right? So, for example, a couple of interesting stories. I think we heard about Ellen saying that, you know, she's friends with George W. Bush. Totally fine. She's certainly a grown person, can do whatever she wants. But the discussion really left out or left stopped explaining why some people might find that disagreeable, right? It was sort of like a lot of the media was like, see, this is a good example versus here's why some people have a problem with that, right? So they're the perspective. And for me, I mean, people I knew who lost people in New Orleans felt like when you give your platform to someone who you personally hold responsible for something very, very bad that happened. So there are people in Iraq who would say, like, I'm not sure how I feel about this. People in Katrina, a lot of people, the soldiers, people who lost loved ones in the war. You know, this idea that their point of view was kind of irrelevant because, hey, she wants to do a selfie with the former president. Just not having that voice was problematic to me.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Soledad O'Brien, who you may know best as a former anchor on CNN, an Emmy-winning journalist, news anchor, and she will be headlining Illinois State University's Latino Cultural Dinner on November 4th at the Brown Ballroom of Bone Student Center. And Soledad, as a child of immigrants, your mother from Cuba, your father from Australia, I understand you lost both of your parents this year. How did your upbringing as a family of immigrants shape your view of the immigration problem we have in the U.S. today?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I think we've never really had very non-charged conversations around immigration. I think at the beginning when I was growing up, my mother used to always say, you know, don't let anybody tell you you're not Latino, which is in a community where there's no Latinos, it's such a weird thing to tell a kid. I used to think my mother was 100% insane because there was no one who was saying, like, you're not Latino. If anything, the opposite was true. And it wasn't until I was in my 40s, actually, that I began to understand her point, which was don't let people define you and your value because of what their perception is of you. And by the way, my family is an exact representation of how it works. The first generation, you and I have people in the family. Grandmother never learned any English. My mom did when she came. I obviously learned English, but my Spanish was pretty good. But my kids really struggle, right? Because that's the story. They lose the language, and it's very frustrating. It's very difficult. So usually by the next generation, everybody's like, no, my kid's going to learn the language of their great-grandparents. But this idea that somehow immigrants come and they don't assimilate, it's just not true. And when you have someone who's well-respected spewing something that is just factually untrue, as if somehow immigrants don't want to embrace all the opportunities here and also don't help create a new definition of what it means to be an American, I think that's malicious, frankly.
Well, Soledad is the host of a news magazine on Sunday mornings called Matter of Fact. This is at a time when most of the political shows go to talking heads, the surrogates, two surrogates on opposite sides of an issue. These programs are ever present on cable news, of course, including CNN, where you used to work. You seem to feel these programs are not particularly illuminating. What do you feel the purpose of these are?
They're done because you want the sense of urgency. Listen, let me tell you something for anybody who's wondering. Having been part of these, they're done so that it looks like there is urgency and that there's conflict, and we know conflict sells, right? So if you have people fighting, it feels urgent. It gets everybody riled up, but there is no, it's a cheap way to do it. It's inexpensive to have talking heads who are basically paid over a year to be contributors to the network. What's much more expensive is to go out in the field and explain things. And so we try in our show, matter of fact, to go into the field and tell stories about what's happening. And you find when you tell stories about people, everything becomes less about, well, he's a Republican and he's a Democrat. Even though we do a political show, it's much more around policy. Why is there a housing crisis? How should people who are unable to get jobs figure out the change in the economy? Things like that, where it doesn't break down into Democrats and Republicans because everybody's affected. It's a policy conversation. And we have found that far more meaningful and far more valuable than just Bob's on the left, Sue's on the right, and now they're going to scream at each other for the next 10 minutes. Nobody likes that. I know people think it's a winning formula for ratings. It really is not. It does not win.
As we continue on Sound Ideas with the Soldat O'Brien, who is coming to Illinois State University for the Latino Cultural Dinner on November 4th, confidence in journalism is starting to rebound after bottoming out in 2016, but it's still lower than it was back in the 80s and 90s, like a lot of American institutions. How would you describe the state of American media now?
You know, I think the definition is shifting, and we're trying to figure it out in a lot of ways. I think there's been a disinvestment in local news, which is really disappointing. And as much as people talk about the New York Times or ESPN or all the big cable networks, really, the tragedy is in that small local newspapers are leaving communities because it's not, you know, financially viable. That is the disaster that's unfolding that very few people talk about. All the other stuff, listen, CNN's going to be just fine. The New York Times is going to be just fine. I think they make some very, very big tactical errors in how they think about the news, and hopefully they'll one day review what they've done right and what they've done wrong and make some changes. And I think the arguments and the debates are really, really healthy. What people don't talk about is small towns where you've never even heard of their paper, where their paper folds because there's just no financial support for it. That is truly a tragedy. No one's watching school board. No one's watching elected officials. No one's really watching, the police department. You know, that's a real tragedy.
Do you feel that trust in American media is starting to rebound, aside from what we hear often in some elements of the media that we know the term fake news, but do you feel that is changing in recent time?
Listen, I was at the airport not too long ago, and our flight was delayed. And they had a time up on the wall that said we were going to leave at, let's say, 8:35. But it was already 8:45, right? So clearly we were not leaving at 8:35. Everyone started shouting, fake news, fake news. So sometimes I think, this concept of people not really having faith in the media is a little bit overstated. I think people like the media that they like, and they like the media when the media tells the stories that they like. It's more complicated than just yes, no. Listen, nobody is harsher on the New York Times than me, and no one retweets more of the great stories as the New York Times does than me. So does that mean I think there's fake news? I don't. I think that term is ridiculous because when everybody's shouting it at a clock, it's an indication like that jumped the shark a little bit. But I do think, people can do better, and holding people accountable is important. And that's a much more important discussion.
Well, that dovetails into my next question about social media. And you are quite active on social media and often outspoken, often slamming President Trump, Republicans.
I will just call a liar a liar. And I do think I love social media because, at sometimes the time is right. If someone is lying, I don't even care if they're a Republican, a Democrat, whoever. If you're lying, you're lying. And I think it's very refreshing to have someone who can just say, this statement is not true. This person is a liar. This person is a coward. The idea that, let's use Joni Ernst for a good example, who has served her country in the military, cannot answer the question about whether it's okay for a president to be involved in calling in a foreign country to be involved in another country's election, which, by the way, is in the Constitution. It's not that complicated. You know, it's just this idea. So let's call that out because we understand what's going on. It's not that she doesn't know. It's not that she needs to, more time to understand the issue. It's not that she hasn't read it, which is all the excuses that people use. It's that she doesn't want to answer a question that puts her directly in conflict with the president because she's aware that the president will call her out and attack her. So she chooses a more cowardly option. That's just a fact. That is just a fact. So all the people who are talking about the Kurds today, and saying we're going to pray for the Kurds, but who at the same time have enabled a president to do these things, that is hypocritical. And they are cowardly, and I think people need to be able to understand that. That's not, you know, some kind of going out on a limb. That's just a fact. We've opened up a group of people to be massacred. And there are people who have done it, who have their fingers on it, and everyone should know.
That was journalist Soledad O'Brien with WGLT's Eric Stock. O'Brien and her husband run the Powerful Foundation that mentors women to help send them to college. The foundation has raised over $5 million since 2006. O'Brien is the multicultural, Latino cultural dinner speaker at the Bone Student Center tonight. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Eric Stock and correspondent Brianna Groh. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.